weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Rising temperatures are having ripple effects across the country, from California's melting snowpack to the ongoing drought in central Illinois. Let's start with California's snowpack.
California's third snow survey of the season is in the books. Up to this point, the statewide snowpack is about 20% lower than it was during this time last year. On top of that, some parts of the Sierra are faring far worse than others. Up to this point, the Southern Sierra snowpack is 90% of average for this time of year, but the Central Sierra is way behind at 67%, and the Northern Sierra is even worse at 46%.
California relies on the Sierra Nevada snowpack for about 30% of its water supply, but this year it's been melting earlier and faster than expected. Here to talk about California's water resources is Trent Ford, Illinois State Climatologist with the Prairie Institute. Thanks for joining us, Trent.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
So, Trent, can you start by explaining what a snowpack is and why the Sierra Nevada snowpack is so important for California's water supply?
Yeah, so, you know, depending on where somebody's listening to this at, across Illinois, let's say, or parts of Indiana, if you're in northern Illinois, a snowpack is probably fairly common. We can get some snow, and because it stays cold for a while, that snow that falls on the ground sticks around for a little while. In southern Illinois, there's very, very, very rarely is there a snowpack, because the snow sticks around for a day or two before it gets back up and melts it. But out west, especially at elevation and the higher elevation parts of the mountains, they get the majority of their precipitation as snow during the wintertime. And that snow that falls in December or January oftentimes sticks around until March or April because of temperatures just not getting above freezing very often. Now, that's something that is just a trademark of the Western U.S. climate, both in the Sierras and the Rockies, and has been that way for centuries. The reason that snowpack is so important to California's water supply is because when that area of the country started being developed after following European settlement, that sort of reliability of gaining snowpack or snow in the winter that then very, very slowly melts and then runs off into streams during the spring and the summer was something that a lot of folks could rely on. And so the idea was, well, we can build reservoirs to capture that, because that area of the country does not get much precipitation during the summer, the vast majority coming in the wintertime. So we can capture some of that water and use it for our water demands in the summertime. That's in a reservoir. And by the way, we can generate free power from this water as it flows down the mountains through hydropower. So both the California's water supply and historically much of its energy have relied on that snowpack coming in the winter, sticking around long enough to slowly melt through the spring and summer, providing that more reliable water supply.
So historically, we're reaching the end of winter when typically snowpack starts to transition over to springtime precipitation. So typically April 1st, which of course is a very important holiday for most comedians, but also is the benchmark for when the snowpack reaches its peak and begins to melt. So can you talk about that date in particular and why it's so special?
Yeah, it's funny. There's actually not a whole lot special about April 1st from snow. Like you said, April Fool's Day is wonderful. And I think a lot of the Western U.S. is probably going to get an April Fool's surprise when they look at April 1st snowpack this year. But that was selected as a sort of scientific standard because across all of the watersheds and all the basins that are primarily snow melt fed for their water, that's typically when we start to see some of the melting and just close to peak snowpack. So some folks may be surprised that actually the as far as liquid water content is concerned, the most snow typically in parts of Colorado and California and Utah tend to fall kind of at late February to late March period, more so even than December and January, depending on the year. And so oftentimes, or historically, we would hit that peak snowpack right around April 1st. And of course, it differed if you were way up in the mountains or a little bit of a middle elevation kind of area. But that is just sort of seen now as the date when we say, okay, what across the region, what is our snowpack conditions look like? Understanding that it's pretty rare to gain snowpack after that April 1st date. And so April 1st is taken as, okay, across the basin, what do things look like? And then our water runoff projections, and then of course, energy projections and everything like that start to be made based on those April 1st measurements.
Yeah, unfortunately this year it is going to be a cruel April 1st joke. We're seeing earlier and faster melting.
Officials today saying that snowpack is melting at 1% per day. And if this trend continues, the April 1st snowpack measurement could be the second lowest in history.
Yeah, so this winter for a lot of basins out west was not a good one for snowpack. There were some areas this year in Nevada's, including in parts of California, that did get a lot of snowpack over a relatively short period of time. But for the region as a whole, it was not a productive snowpack season, meaning that even kind of setting aside the earlier melting, just the total amount of snow the region received was way below what they typically receive. So first of all, most basins were dealing with just less snowpack overall. Second, the milder temperatures, the milder weather that sort of has plagued the region over the last, several months at least, that also culminated with that huge heat wave that the region dealt with last week, has made it so that any snow that has fallen and snowpack that has built up has been whittled and melted very, very quickly. So, you know, it's lesser sort of applied here in the Midwest, although we can have snow drought is what it's called, but snow drought is a huge issue out west because of how much they depend on snow for water and energy supplies. So there's basically two ways you can get a snow drought. One is that you just don't get enough snow, which a lot of basins had. The second is you get plenty of snow or plenty of precipitation, but it's just too warm for keeping that snow around. And actually this year they got both. It was much too warm to keep a snowpack around, and the snowpack they got was just weaker than normal.
So obviously this is not going to be good for the economy. Food prices are already high. A lot of these areas are a breadbasket for vegetables and fruits growing this time of year. What is this going to mean for this summer?
Power production, water, those prices tend to be supply-demand driven, among many other things. It's a little bit more complex in California, but so, of course, power production being an issue, meaning that power prices, at least out west, could be higher. This is an area, as you mentioned, that produces the majority of the nation's fruit and vegetables, especially in the Central Valley of California. Now, those places irrigate based off of a lot of groundwater, but that's becoming a less and less sustainable practice. And so overall, the having years like this really puts those kind of practices in the crosshairs, which can affect food prices. The other major impact that we tend to see in years like this is fire. This is a wildfire-prone region. And when we get these kind of very, very poor snowpack years, especially following years that are otherwise wet, it can produce a lot of an earlier and more extended, more magnified fire season. So this is something that I know that the fire agencies, both federally and state, are already sort of gearing up for. And that's, of course, something we don't want to see. Obviously, fire is a huge hazard there. It affects us here in the Midwest, too. We've seen that in recent years with air quality. So that's something we're going to be probably hearing about and watching this summer.
A lot of us, some listeners out there may have had a ski vacation planned this winter and were somewhat disappointed. I saw a lot of pictures on social media of brown, icy snow. In the future, obviously, the snowpack is important for a lot of aspects of the Western U.S. economy. How is this projected to change going forward? We saw this extreme heat wave, but long term, what are we thinking?
Yeah, you know, this overall, what we've seen for this region and the projections of what to expect with climate change moving forward is warmer, more arid type of atmospheric conditions, meaning more demand for that evaporation, warmer in the wintertime, meaning overall less snowpack, carrying snowpack through. those issues are likely going to remain. Whether or not the dryness through the lack of precipitation overall in the region is driven more by climate change or by these kind of long-term variability like we talked about earlier, setting that aside, these long-term trends in warming and evaporative demand are likely making this region more arid overall. So these are issues with snowpack and early melting that are likely going to continue even in years where we get a good healthy snowpack where it's melting earlier than expected. You mentioned recreation with skiing. There was actually a report produced this week earlier that is an interesting story about how the ski industry, especially in the West, has sort of been less than proactive on climate change, both in the actions it's taking as well as the sort of advocacy for adaptation practices and federal policy that can shield that or at least protect somewhat that industry from the impact of climate change, because the projections are pretty clear that we are warmer, whether or not we get drier or warmer, Western U.S. means less predictable, less reliable skiing. And that's a huge industry out there. So it's something that'll be, I think, that industry is going to have to grapple with.
So you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about the climate and weather. We've been talking about how rising temperatures are affecting California's snowpack. Now we're bringing this segment back home to talk about what this means for drought conditions in Illinois and how communities are preparing for the summer months. Joining us now is John Dwyer, Emergency Response Planner with the Champaign County Emergency Management Agency. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So Champaign County is still experiencing significant drought conditions. Over 200,000 people in our county have been affected by the drought, and last month was considered the driest February on record for the past 132 years. From an emergency planning perspective, John, how concerning are the drought conditions here in Champaign County for you?
It was very concerning, especially after last year when in August or April, we had our first massive dust storm warning where it was hard to see for about a half hour on the roads and just the dust cloud that hit. And then over in the summer during harvest season, we had several field fires, and then some of the fertilizer companies actually pre-staged some water tanks that if there was a field fire that our local departments could just grab in a hurry and help out with the with combating the fire. So definitely, you know, fire risk is one of them. But we've seen communities outside of Champaign that are doing water rationing right now, worried about their water supply.
A month ago, the city of Sullivan was asking people to voluntarily conserve water.
Now they're making it a requirement after announcing a water emergency and temporarily shutting down some businesses in the area.
A statewide drought has caused levels in the Bloomington Water Reservoir to drop 5 feet below its standard volume. And because of this, city officials and Water Administration are asking people to use water only when they need to.
Lucky for Champaign-Urbana, we get most of our water from the Muhammad Aquifer. But surface water, wells, there are some wells in the county that are dry that people are having to bring in water. So far this month, we have gotten rain, but I still think we're about 12 inches or more behind. So it's a concern that, you know, what will crops yield will affect the people's private well and supplies. And then if we do get planting done, what happens later in the summer? Is there a good crop or are there going to be a fire risk when they're harvesting?
So what is some of the worst case scenarios you could think about here?
That there's not a good harvest yield and that we have a number of wells that run dry that we got to figure out how to get water to those people. So those are some of our biggest concerns. And we're actually having a drought workshop late April with National Weather Service, Lincoln, Illinois Climatology, and some other Illinois American Water and local emergency managers just to discuss what worst case and how we can collaborate if things get continually worse, or if they get better, then great. And then also speaking of drought or just even the summer heat, where people can take shelter, because most of the public buildings are closed during regular, you know, after business hours, and it doesn't do it. It's difficult for people that are shelter challenged to find a place to cool off when it's 10 o'clock at night and it's still over 100 degrees or 95 degrees with the heat.
Yeah, we're not a stranger, I guess, to some of these extreme events. I've lived here for about 20 years. I've heard stories about the 1988 drought. And of course, in 2012, which is a more recent event, we had an event that led to extreme temperatures later on in the summertime.
Yes.
Have we sort of learned lessons about this and how to have our agencies adapt better and provide more resources? Can you give some examples of how that may be the case?
Well, I also work with our local Farm Bureau, so I always like to say it's disasters and emergencies aren't your time to pass out business cards or contact information. So by us meeting ahead of time with the Weather Service, offices like Trent's office, you know, climatology that know what's going on ahead of time is where some of the lessons learned start making those relationships. This past year or last year, I had one farmer that I didn't realize that crop insurance only covers one yield, and they were waiting for a disaster declaration. They were actually a hay farmer, and they were depending on three yields, and I think they only got one out of the three, and that created financial burden. So I worked with the Farm Bureau, the state, to make sure that they were eligible for a USDA disaster fund. It took a while with the government shutdown, but that's one of the things I didn't know was out there, but that kept her farm afloat. So it's programs like that and keeping those that could be affected informed.
For farmers, I would imagine this is not a fun time to be in that business. You've got a lot of pressure from the large-scale economy. Is there anything that farmers can do in particular to help perhaps produce at least somewhat of a decent crop this year with all this going on?
I would say keep in touch with the Farm Bureau and work with some of their programs. And we got some of the best agricultural experts here with the university. And they're out and about in our community. So we're lucky that they're in our backyard.
You know, we, at least with drought, get a little bit of the benefit of a heads up, right? It doesn't just develop overnight. But, you know, thinking about the summer, and if it were to, not saying this is what's predicted, but if it were to evolve something like a 2012 where it got very dry and hot in the middle of the growing season, you know, does Champaign County have sort of a plan of action for drought or the individual municipalities within the county and how that goes about being enacted and what you all are looking at to make those decisions?
That's what I'm looking at, but I'm not a decision maker. So that's where we got to know where we're at. And that's one of the reasons with Illinois American Water, there may be, we have access to the aquifer, but we're not water rationing. Or saying people, hey, conserve water, yet municipalities are using their wells or whatever, and trying to be all on the same page, that's going to be a challenge. Also working with park district, do we keep the pools and the water parks open? We're telling people to water ration. I know that's one of the challenges in Sullivan where they ask people to water ration and come to find out there was no difference when they made the announcement. So I think they even heard that maybe they stopped car washes. So that's the other thing of farmers and whatever businesses, how do you tell them to stop doing something that's their livelihood? It's not just the water aspect, but also dust conditions. You asked about lessons learned. Well, that dust storm they had on I-55 where eight people lost their life, where, you know, it was just the right conditions where all that dust went across the interstate and caused all those accidents a few years ago. We actually had their emergency manager and their fire chief on scene commander come and speak to our departments about that. And I think we were really lucky in late April last year when that dust storm came that there were very few accidents,
none serious that I heard of as a result of that, but that popped up really quick. And we could have the same thing in the fall or towards planting season. It may not be dust, but it could be smoke from the from a field fire where it moves across the interstate. Or even where it jumps. And the other thing, talking with the Farm Bureau, a while back when we had the fire in Ogden that I believe it jumped the interstate, it was farmers that went out there and tilled the soil to push the stalks or whatever down. That helped. And then also there was some equipment damage. So how do you ensure them they're not firefighters, but they are providing a response to prevent the spread of the fire and things like that. So those are some of the lessons learned. We're working with, you know, the fire districts, insurance companies, because it was easier for the fire, for the farmers to till the soil than it was to get to the fire trucks to the scene at that time because of the traffic and things like that. So it's unique, but it's something that we've learned lessons from and the fire departments are working on now.
So you are leading a drought workshop coming up on April 21st. What are some of the things you plan to discuss at that meeting?
We hope to have experts from the Weather Service, but basically we're going to look at the current state of drought monitoring and the prediction and the planning for East Central Illinois. We're going to discuss communications among the agencies and guidance and any tools that are out there and approaches for assessing and monitoring the drought and how resilient we are. And then we're going to talk about drought research and learn from one another to build stronger connections and improve coordination amongst East Central Illinois. Like I said, we don't want to be, oh my God, water's down. Who do we talk to? So we're making new connections, whether it's the Illinois EPA, state climatology, public health, Illinois American Water, the municipalities, to help each other out and just see what happens. Hopefully the plan is not enacted or, you know, but at least we're discussing it before it gets too bad.
So those of you just tuning in, we're speaking with John Dwyer, Emergency Response Planner with the Champaign County Emergency Management. John, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Steve Nesbitt. Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu and our experts will answer your questions.
Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
Stephanie Orellana, and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.